scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new film Serenity, In Like Flynn, King of Thieves, and The Kid Who Would Be King. I'm also going to be talking about some news. I'll visit the trailer park and do the home cinema roundup featuring Johnny English Strikes Again and Cobra. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The big news this week that hit entertainment is the Oscar nominations came out on, well, Tuesday. It wouldn't have come out Monday because it was a holiday, so they came out on Tuesday morning. And the big surprise is there was no really huge surprises there. It's the same films we've seen percolating around from the Golden Globes to the Critics' Choice to producers and SAG and all that kind of entities. So, like any year, you're seeing a lot of the same names filtering around. Now, there are certain ones, like Bradley Cooper wasn't nominated for director for A Star Is Born. I think that bodes poorly for the movie, and that's an upset, I think, to a lot of people who are in his camp to win Best Director. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that it's his first time. They generally don't like to nominate, let alone give an Academy Award for the first-time directors. Case in point, Spike Lee, his earlier film, Do the Right Thing, from 1989. That movie, he was nominated for a directing Oscar, and he didn't win, and they think it's possible that he could win this time around. But I don't necessarily think that's going to happen. I think when you look at the spread of things, there is no front runner, and that makes it an interesting field because it's kind of anyone's game. I think, though, Roma's the one to beat. And I know a lot of people aren't leaning towards that. They're all saying, oh, it's potentially A Star Is Born or even Bohemian Rhapsody because that won the Golden Globe. But A Star Is Born is the one that doesn't have any sort of controversy around it. There's controversy around Green Book. There's controversy around Bohemian Rhapsody. Roma is just sort of out there on its own. And there's nothing negative about it. That's out, and it also is nominated for enough awards throughout. It's one of those films that I think is going to rise above everybody else, mainly because the vote's going to be split rather evenly. You're not going to get that one film that gets like 70% of the vote. It's sort of like a European election in that sort of way. Now, in terms of the acting Oscars, I think the biggest one to watch is Best Actress, because Lady Gaga and Glenn Close, I think it's a horse race between the two of them. I don't know who it's going to be. I mean, they tied Critics' Choice, and Glenn Close beat her in the Golden Globes. But you might see Lady Gaga get the award. For Best Actor, it's going to be Christian Bale. I think Mahershala Ali and Regina King have it sewn up for the supporting actor and actress category. And yeah, I mean, Black Panther, it's great that it got nominated. First official superhero movie to get nominated. It's not going to win. It doesn't stand a chance of winning. I do think it's always funny when they can do 10 nominations, but they only do 8. And they're like, no, Crazy Rich Asians, we're not going to give it to you. First Reform, nah, we're not going to do it. And I know some people are upset First Reform didn't get a nomination for Ethan Hawke, but I think that was an underseen movie in a lot of ways. I don't think you can say the same thing about Crazy Rich Asians. I just think that the Academy is still reluctant to give a nomination to a movie that they consider too popular, I guess you could say. I mean, Black Panther had to go in there because I think people would have lost their mind if it didn't get nominated. The next piece of news isn't a piece of news. This is just a little observation I had. I went to go see a movie this week. I went to go see Serenity. I had to go check it out on Thursday night because they didn't screen it locally for me. And what's the weirdest thing that you've seen somebody bring into a movie theater? I went in and I sat way in the back, and this woman had brought in like literally an entire like take home Walmart bag, you know, like one of those bags that you bring yourself and you fill up and you take it home and it's not disposable. It's a reuse bag. And it was filled with snacks. I mean, she was pulling out potato chips, ripping them open. She at one point opened a can. I couldn't tell whether it was beer or soda, but I'm watching this movie and all of a sudden to the side, I hear this. I didn't know what it was. I look over. She had brought a can of Cheese Whiz in and was spraying it on either a cracker or a chip or something. I mean, this movie's an hour and 45 minutes. Why did you bring an entire bag of food? I've been known to sneak in snacks. Heck, I do that all the time. I walk into my theaters now with a cup of coffee, and they're just like, yeah, it's just Kevin. Let him go. But this woman, she went to the store for this. And I understand if you went to go see, like, they're doing the Best Picture Showcase where they're showing 24 hours of Best Picture movies, or like when they would do the Avengers Showcase and they'd watch 10 Marvel movies. I understand people bringing in a bag of snacks for that. But for a movie that has a running time of less than 2 hours, that's just ridiculous. I'm just curious what anyone else has ever, what's the weirdest thing you've ever encountered with somebody bringing into a theater? You know, hey. Hit me up, fatguys@fatguysatthemovies, or 740-205-6456. Let me know. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Couple films I want to hit really quickly. The first one is a Netflix movie, High Flying Bird, which drops on the service on February 8th.
Football is fun, but it don't sell sneakers. To move merch and inspire rap lyrics, they need your services.
The NBA wanted control of a game that we played. We played better. They invented a game on top of a game.
I can see a whole infrastructure that put the control back in the hands of those behind the ball.
What you gonna do?
But I'm about to pull up a chair.
The reason I'm covering this one is because it's Netflix continuing its run of taking huge directors or stars and putting them on its service. Of course, we had the Coen brothers doing The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. And of course, you had Roma, which I talked about earlier in the Academy Awards, Alfonso Cuarón's personal story. And he's an Academy Award winning director. And I mean, not somebody who won an Academy Award 20 years ago. He just won an Academy Award a few years ago, and he's putting stuff on Netflix. This one is directed by Steven Soderbergh, and it's about basketball. I don't know anything about basketball. I couldn't even tell you if this is true or not, or if it's possible. It's about this is basically I think it's a sports agent who's trying to game his way around an NBA lockout. But what's important about it is that it is a major director on Netflix, which is getting more and more common. It's also another film that Soderbergh shot with an iPhone. And he did Unsane that way, but Unsane has a gritty, more 70s look to it. This one looks a lot more slick. This one looks more like an Ocean's 11 movie than it does, you know, Sex, Lies, and Videotape or something like that that Soderbergh's famous for. So this is one to check out. Even if I don't like basketball, I might check it out just because I'm curious to see the filmmaking element of it. The next one I want to hit really quickly is The Man Who Killed Hitler and then Bigfoot, which opens also on February 8th.
What's bothering you?
Things I could have done differently. Regrets. I shot someone during the war. I never wanted that. Even if he had it coming. And he did.
You heard about the killings up north?
What's the FBI have to do with it?
Imagine all our worst fears about influenza, bovine, swine, all of it coming true to life, only worse.
It's the Bigfoot, Ed. Kill him and kill it.
This one stars Sam Elliott, Academy Award nominated Sam Elliott. And I this looks interesting. It looks very low rent. It looks very much like it was a small budget independent film that's going for kind of weird and quirkiness, something like Bubba Hotep. You know, you got a guy who's known for killing Hitler and going after Bigfoot that's spreading a deadly flu. This is certainly out of the box. It sounds like a weird movie. I'm curious to see it, although I get a sense from the trailer it just doesn't feel as high rent as a normal theatrical picture. Kind of like that movie Big Game, that one where Samuel L. Jackson was the president of the United States, then he crashes somewhere in the wilderness and a kid has to help him out. That's a great concept, but it felt like a direct-to-video type movie. And I get that feel of this from the trailer. Still, I want to check it out. I like Sam Elliott, and this looks like a neat film. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about King of Thieves and the Kid Who Would Be King.
We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews with a couple of King Lee films. See what I did there? The first one is King of Thieves. A group of geriatric bank robbers go for one final score in London when they team up with a man with inside knowledge of a bank's security system.
Hatton Garden, Easter, no one at home, and the vault is ours.
Ken?
The problem with gold, it's easy to get, but it's difficult to get rid of.
Police have said this is the biggest robbery in UK history.
Everyone thinks you've lost your nerve.
Well, I don't want to get caught again. I am not stupid.
Unless they're complete idiots, the jewels must have already left the country.
I said to the rep after seeing this movie, they asked me for feedback, and I said, look, I can watch a Michael Caine heist movie every day. I think he's great. I love Michael Caine as an actor, and I think he's got a wonderful career. I also love the fact that now he's in his 80s and he's just doing movies as Michael Caine. He's basically being the smart-talking, loud Michael Caine that you're used to. I don't think he's doing... he's not doing these heavy, deep-dive acting roles right now because he's in his 80s. He doesn't need to. He did those. You want those? You've got an entire half or more of cinema history involves Michael Caine in movies. And he's done his part. And I love the fact that now he's just like collecting paychecks to play what is essentially his grumpy old man persona. But I absolutely liked it. And I thought what was neat about it is it reminded me a little bit of that movie Going in Style, the remake, the one that Zach Braff directed. That one didn't do well, but I liked that idea of old guys pulling off a heist. And this is actually based on a true story. Hundreds of millions of pounds were stolen from this safe deposit box in this bank. And we're talking stuff like gold and not just money, but like diamonds and precious metals. And I'm sure like the stuff that, you know, some people like my parents have a safe deposit box and I know they've put stuff in there that's important to them, but isn't worth of any value to anybody outside of like our family. You know, it'd be stuff like if, you know, you could put your passport in there or your birth certificate, but you know, I mean, who cares about getting somebody's birth certificate when you're trying to get like diamonds that are worth $100,000 a piece? The movie itself is worth seeing simply to see all the actors involved because it's not just Michael Caine. You've got Jim Broadbent in there. You've got Michael Gambon in there. You've got Ray Winstone in there. There's a great group of older British actors playing in this part and it's neat to see them go. And it's also neat to see all their interactions. They all have this great chemistry. And the basic story is just these guys doing a final run. They're like, hey, let's do this. But then of course they start to turn on each other and they don't cohesively work together. And there's also an interesting sort of subtext that they don't berate and they don't overstate too much, but there's the implication that because they're older bank robbers, they don't quite understand or aren't fully savvy to how wired London is for surveillance ability because they're older school. They were knocking over banks in the 60s when they didn't have closed circuit cameras that could all be networked by a computer with facial recognition software. In the end, the movie is about the relationships and Michael Caine is sort of the crux of it and he comes and goes. And I think part of it is they have to follow the true story a bit, but it's also just fun to watch the actors. I think Ray Winstone is the one that everyone forgets. Everyone remembers Jim Broadbent. He's a great actor and he's good in this movie. And of course, Michael Caine, he's sort of the anchor of this movie, but Ray Winstone is what's great about him is he's old enough that he can still play the old man of saying, well, I've got these problems and this problem and I can't necessarily do what I could do when I was younger. But he's also young enough, because I think Winstone's like in his early 60s. He's still young enough that, you know, he's a strapping guy. He's strong. He looks healthy. I mean, he's overweight, but he still looks like somebody who could go into a barroom brawl and quite easily win. He's not feeble. He doesn't look like he's ready to break, and he can still sort of play that gangster type. It's a little bit floppy on the plot. The story has trouble figuring out its entire path, and that's normal for something that's based on a true story like this one is. But overall, it's very well done and a lot of fun. And I just enjoyed watching these guys mix it up for sort of like that one last big score that doesn't necessarily go as well as they hoped it would. And also to show the difference in what you would do bank robbing 30, 40 years ago compared to what you would do now. So in the end, I'm going to have to say that King of Thieves kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Kid Who Would Be King. A school kid discovers that he is destined to wield Excalibur and defeat the sorceress Morgana.
Benz, you've got to see what I found.
There's something written on the guard. Put it into Google Translate.
It means Sword of Arthur. What if you're the only person who could have pulled that sword out? What if it's Excalibur?
Ah, finally. Follow me.
I am Merlin.
In 4 days, the dark sorcerer Morgana will take over the world.
Awaken my warriors.
Am I supposed to stop her? That's ridiculous.
I remember when the trailer for this dropped not too long ago, and I played it on the show, and I said it could be one of those attempting to be a Harry Potter type movie. Any sort of fantasy element with school-age children, you immediately feel is going to be a Harry Potter ripoff. You know, stuff like Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief, teen books that have been turned into series. And part of the problem with the teen series is a lot of times that young adult literature doesn't really translate to an audience beyond its target audience in the books. And I'm not going to say it's poorly written. I'm just saying that some of these stories are so centered on the kids that they ignore the realities of a bigger world. So like kids can read it, but once you become an adult, you realize that it's kind of hogwash. The Maze Runner was like that. The Fifth Wave was like that. You know, I as I understand, although I didn't see it, Dangerous Minds or whatever that was with the kids with the mental powers, that one was apparently like that. So I did feel that this looked like it did cross that generational gap. And then later on, I found out it was directed by Joe Cornish. And Joe Cornish did the movie Attack the Block several years ago. It's the one movie that gave John Boyega his start. Before he got into Star Wars, he was in Attack the Block. And that's a great little movie. I mean, it's a lot of fun. And Joe Cornish really has an ability to direct an action movie that I think would be accessible to a younger generation, but also is just a very good mainstream movie. And the big reason Attack the Block, I don't think it took hold in America the way it could have, is because everyone was talking British slang. And they were actually talking about in that movie that they wanted to put subtitles on it to release it in America because the accents were, and the slang was so thick. It was sort of like train spotting, kind of hard to understand if you're just a big dumb American who's not used to listening to British or Scottish or accents or something like that. So I think The Kid Who Would Be King looks really interesting. The problem is that they didn't screen it locally for me, and they didn't even have Thursday night shows. I think that's they're botching the release in America because they're thinking, oh, it's a kid's movie and it's British and no one's going to see it anyways, when it might be really good. So I have to say it's a preemptive suck, but I'm probably going to go check it out and talk about it next week.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Serenity and In Like Flynn. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Serenity. Matthew McConaughey stars as a loner fisherman on a small tropical island who is confronted by his ex-wife to kill her abusive husband and later finding out things aren't always what they seem.
Please don't kill that man.
What?
I will give you $10 million
to drop my husband in the ocean for the sharks.
There's right and wrong, heaven and hell.
Some weird stuff going on right now. This whole island's a part of it, but nobody knows it.
Okay, John, you want the truth?
You don't.
It didn't screen anywhere, and it's a smaller studio that put it out, and that might be why they didn't screen it. And as I understand, like even the LA screening, I believe, was on Wednesday night this week, which is always a bad sign when the LA screening is that late. Usually, I live in Columbus, Ohio, so usually a screening, if they screen a movie, they screen it the week of its release, usually on Monday or Tuesday, sometimes on Wednesday. But usually you can go see the movie on Thursday night anyway. So there's no point in having a Thursday night screening unless you're screening a movie ultimately a week or so early. Now, the LA screening and the New York screening, a lot of times they do those a couple weeks in advance. It's not uncommon to see my friends out in LA tweeting about seeing a movie, you know, a week before I do, and even though we all get to see it early. But as I understand, the LA screening was on Wednesday, and that doesn't bode well for buzz. Usually, studios like to have a certain degree of buzz going into the release. They want to have private screenings and public screenings, so not just journalists write about it and do early reviews, but for the fans of the movies, the people to go see the movies could then go tweet about it and talk about it on social media. Whenever they start to restrict it with embargoes and such, that's usually a bad sign. Unless they're showing it so early they don't want people to talk about it until it's that couple weeks leading up to the movie. And I had heard some mixed buzz about this movie, but I still didn't know much about it at all. So I went to go see it very cold. And look, the first hour of this movie is boring. Because it's this guy, he's on this island, and he's going out and taking people fishing, but he wants to catch, there's apparently this big tuna, this giant tuna, that he keeps hooking, and it keeps escaping, and he's obsessed with it, and, you know, it's Matthew McConaughey doing a lot of drinking and flopping around this island. When he needs money, he goes and he has sex with Diane Lane because she pays him. I mean, wouldn't that be great? You'd be like, oh, I have to go get paid to have sex with somebody. Oh, I'll take Diane Lane. Now, granted, it's Matthew McConaughey, so, I mean, he's a good-looking guy anyway, so. But, I mean, it's not like he's like, oh, I need to go make some money. Okay, Roseanne Barr, let's get it on. You know, something like that. It's him being, basically a gigolo, and she funds him. I don't know why it's that one person on the island who does it. But the movie's trying to be a Hitchcock movie. It's got intense music, and it's got sort of that noir look to it, especially in the nighttime scenes, and especially when Anne Hathaway shows up as his ex-wife. She's wearing clothes that frames her in such a way that she looks, it's very black and white. And I mean, they take care to try to make it suspenseful, but there's really no suspense there. It's just your body responds to triggers of it being, you know, the soundtrack. You're like, oh, this scene should be very suspenseful, but there's really nothing suspenseful happening in this scene. And then they double down on that soundtrack over and over and over again, so that by the point you're like 30, 40 minutes into the movie, that the soundtrack is so intense, and they're still just talking about fish. But yeah, and then they introduce this thing where she wants him to kill her abusive husband, and then an hour in, finally, like an hour in, something interesting happens. I can't tell you what it is, but it does change the movie considerably. And the reason I can't tell you is because it's a huge spoiler. I can't even talk about what it could be, because just contemplating what it means and what could happen is a spoiler in itself. So there's this really neat reveal, almost like an M. Night Shyamalan movie where the reveal comes halfway through the film. The problem is as clever as it was, then they start to over-explain it. And you're just like, okay, yeah, idiot, I get it. I know what's going on. You don't have to drive this into the ground for me. And so while it has some interesting things that are happening, and I was curious to see how it plays out, especially when this new part was introduced halfway through the movie, or more than halfway through the movie, I wanted to see how it all played out. So I wasn't bored in the movie. I was bored in the first hour, but the last part of the movie I wasn't bored in. I don't think it was terribly well executed. And I mean, Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway certainly throw down acting. I mean, they do a good job, and I always feel bad for actors, especially ones that are doing a good job in the movie, when they're in kind of a crappy movie. It gets an A for effort. The acting performances are good, and actually the cast is really good. You've also got Damon Hansu in there, and you've got Jason Clarke as her abusive husband. I mean, they're and Diane Lane I already mentioned. I mean, there's some really good things about this movie. And so, like I said, it gets an A for effort. It doesn't get an A for anything else, though. The movie itself is not an A. I mean, it's not a great movie. I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks, but it only kind of sucks and not totally sucks because it has some interesting stuff that they botch. But at least, like I said, they give it a shot.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about In Like Flynn. This biopic tells a story of an early life of Errol Flynn and his jungle adventures before he becomes a movie star.
Never thought I'd see Errol Flynn roaming these streets again.
I have something that may be of interest to you.
I've just come back from New Guinea. It's lined with gold. Every fool with a shovel scrambling for a piece.
Full speed ahead!
The sirens of the sea beckon.
Your ship is sinking. The ocean rages. And your crew? Dead.
This is going to hurt a lot.
Errol Flynn is legendary, not just for playing Captain Blood and Robin Hood and a bunch of other famous roles throughout the years that he was active in Hollywood. He was a swashbuckler beforehand. He was one of those people who wanted to go on jungle adventures. And this tells a story about how he's trying to travel to Papua New Guinea to find gold, as a treasure hunter at that point. I have a soft spot for jungle adventure movies. I guess that's growing up watching like Indiana Jones. There's a lot of terrible jungle adventures, like The Phantom. If you remember that movie from the 90s with Billy Zane, Slam Evil. That was a jungle adventure, and it's a terrible movie, but I like the jungle adventure story, like Terry and the Pirates, good old-fashioned Terry and the Pirates, which I've ripped on for years. That's a jungle adventure, and it's kind of fun. I mean, they're always horribly racist and really goofy, and have a guy in a gorilla suit. There's no guy in a gorilla suit in this movie. That was disappointing to me. I mean, it's interesting simply because it's a true story. I mean, I don't know how true it is. I don't know how much liberties are taken. The problem the movie has is, like any biopic, it's not like he had success in getting The Lost Ark or The Covenant or something like that. He was on a failed adventure to get gold. And so he's kind of traveling from port to port, but you really don't see much success. You just see him getting into scrapes. And while that might be accurate historically, it doesn't make a really good, well-plotted movie. There's also some acting problems. I mean, the guy who plays Errol Flynn, he's a good-looking guy, but he's really not that good of an actor. And there's a part in there where he runs into an old flame played by Isabel Lucas, who, oh my God, she looks like she's going to break like a twig. She is so skinny, it's almost grotesque. And she's meant to be portrayed as this beauty. And there's a reason why she did Transformers 2, Red Dawn, and One and Done, and she's out of there. So the cast isn't really all that great. And there's this one guy, the guy who owns the boat that they're on. He's like the best part of the cast, but everybody else is kind of forgettable. That's the biggest problem that this movie has, is the cast. The cast just doesn't have the oomph to it. I mean, he's dressed like Pat Ryan from Terry and the Pirates, which is essentially Han Solo, not in space. So in the end, it's kind of disappointing, and like Flynn kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the box office and the home cinema roundup featuring Johnny English Strikes Again and Cobra. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I'm going to kick things off by going straight into the box office here. Last weekend, Glass topped the box office. Over the four-day weekend, it made over $46 million. I think over the three-day, it was just over $40 million. So it was a little bit softer, I think, than was initially being predicted. But that's still massive money, especially for a movie that was budgeted at like $20 million. This is a huge success for Universal, for M. Night Shyamalan, for all the people involved. And it's probably going to win the weekend this weekend as well. Another one that I didn't even cover this week was Dragon Ball Super Broly, which came in fourth with about $10 million, depending on whether you look at the three-day or the four-day weekend. That's actually really good. Last week's film, A Dog's Way Home, that was no longer above that. So that's about it in terms of box office. So let's move on. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to go into the home cinema roundup. The first one I want to hit, I actually got two films here I want to talk about. The first one is Johnny English Strikes Back. After the MI7 spies have been revealed, the incomparable Johnny English is called back into the field to thwart a cyber terrorist.
We have a problem.
Good.
The identities of our serving agents have been exposed.
The country is in a state of complete chaos. And the universe sends me you.
She's the key to this case.
I'm not sure I've ever met a man quite like you.
Let me clear up the uncertainty for you. You haven't.
Tell me the agent you've got in the field is making some progress.
Target acquired.
You know how I mentioned the kid who would be king? I think the studios are playing it soft into America because it's a British film. And while there's a lot of people in America, me included, who like British humor and British film and television, it's not the mainstream. The mainstream just isn't interested in British stuff. And that's okay. I'm not going to disparage people if you don't like British comedies or whatever. But I think Johnny English runs into the same situation. Johnny English, the first one, was a massive flop in America. And the sequel, Johnny English Reborn, was an even a bigger flop in America. But these movies make hundreds of millions of dollars overseas. They release them in America as an afterthought. They release them in America to be like, oh, okay, we're releasing it. But really, they make their money in Britain, and releasing it in America, they just have to send the prince over, basically. Rowan Atkinson does have a small following in America, but these movies kind of fly under the radar. I tend to like his Mr. Bean stuff a little bit better, but I like a lot of stuff that Rowan Atkinson has done. I like Blackadder, like I said, and Mr. Bean. I think the Johnny English movies, the first one I didn't particularly like. I haven't seen it in a long time. But the second one I thought was actually kind of clever. Not great. I mean, it's a bumbly spy spoof movie. And this one, it's a more well-spoken version of Mr. Bean, who has a modicum of understanding of spy equipment. That's the best way I could describe Johnny English. Ogle Kulurylenko plays the love interest in here, and she is, of course, a former Bond girl himself. Rowan Atkinson was in a Bond movie. He was in Never Say Never Again, although that's not canonical Bond. That's not from the Eon Productions. But it's a fun enough movie. It's a whimsical, silly lark of a film, and it involves most of the comedy of Rowan Atkinson just sort of bumbling around, causing problems, accidentally setting things on fire, botching things up, and it's fun that way. I don't think it's as strong as Johnny English Reborn as I recall that one to be, but it certainly is comparable, and I'd watch another Johnny English movie. Now, what's interesting, the bonus features actually has a decent amount of bonus features. It's got a spotlight on Rowan Atkinson's comedy. It talks about the characters and the legacy of Johnny English, especially is interesting to watch because if you're from America, you don't realize that Johnny English is as big of a franchise as it really is. And it has stuff about the cars and the gadgets and the locations. And of course, there's a feature commentary, which is always nice to have in a movie because it doubles its running time value for whatever you spend on it that you don't necessarily get when you do an on-demand streaming film. So I'm going to have to say Johnny English Strikes Again kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the next film on the docket for the Blu-rays, and that is Cobra. Sylvester Stallone ignites the screen as a rules-defying detective on a search for a vicious street gang.
Society is breeding a new kind of criminal. It's also breeding a new kind of cop. Meet Cobra. He does the job nobody wants.
Did you use unnecessary deadly force?
I used everything I had.
You know you have an attitude problem.
Yeah, but it's just a little one.
Do what you have to do to get a lead on this maniac.
And if I find him,
do what you do best.
I did not see Cobra in the theaters in the 80s. It came out in 1986, and I was 15, maybe 14. I don't know what time of year it came out. But I wouldn't have been allowed to see it. It was rated R, and it was a hard R, too. I even think I remember this back then. It had to get recut. It got an X rating, and it took out a lot of stuff of violent, graphic violence and gore in order to get an R rating. Now, you watch it now, and I think even if you were to look at some of those scenes that they took out, they're kind of tame by today's standards, especially in this world of direct-to-video and unrated DVDs and Blu-rays, where people have access to much more graphic content, and it's easy at your own home, especially on the internet. So it does seem sort of silly, some of the stuff that they censored back in the 80s, but that was a big deal. I wouldn't have been able to go see it. They were being really diligent. Back in the 80s, they were pretty diligent about letting kids who are too young in the theaters to see it. I saw it on VHS, I think a couple years after it came out, and I don't remember it making much of a lasting impression because it was so close to when it came out that they were still making a whole bunch of these tough guy, strong men action movies, 80s and into the 90s. This one, though, I got turned back on to seeing this a couple years ago. I was talking to Gray Drake, who is the pink-haired lady from Rotten Tomatoes. This was, oh gosh, close to 10 years ago, 7 or 8 years ago. Gray and I were talking, and she was telling me about Cobra. And I'm like, I remember seeing that a long time ago. I don't remember making an impression to me. She's like, oh my God, you got to watch it again. It is so bonkers and ridiculous and hilarious. And she's absolutely right. And in rewatching this movie now, having, you know, having watched it a couple of years ago on her recommendation and enjoying it for the silly, goofy, over the top sense that it is, and then going back and watching it again, you're just, this is the quintessential 80s action movie for a tough guy. As much as I like the Chuck Norris movies where he's like, I get even with people by stepping on throats or something like that. That's a goofy line he has in one of his films. This is Stallone kind of at his best. I mean, I know people talk Rocky and Rambo, but this was unfiltered Stallone, just garbage trope movie. And I mean, he drives around this car that looks like the car from the movie, The Car. It's this massive old car with the license plate that says Awesome 50. He always has a matchstick in his mouth and never uses it until the very, very end. He comes home one day and he wants a piece of pizza. So he takes a piece of cold pizza and cuts it in half with a pair of scissors, like those big classroom scissors you had in first grade with the big black handles. He's going after this gang, and this is back in the 80s when everyone was all worried about street gangs organizing and becoming these roving bands of lunatics. And this street gang, they sit around under the sewers banging hatchets together for some unknown reason, and they're causing all these murders and rapes and mayhem around the city. And Stallone has to go in and track him down. Now, the movie ends after a big motorcycle chase with Uzis and automatic weapons and people blowing off of motorcycles and exploding and grenades. It ends in this factory. And what's funny is it takes place, that last scene, it takes place, they mention it's before breakfast. And they drive through town as people are getting out of church. So I don't know how getting out of church is before breakfast. And then they end up at this factory, which is apparently opened on a Sunday. And Gray said to me when she was telling me, she goes, it's a hook and fire factory. I'm like, what do you mean by that? She goes, no, it's a factory that they only must make rusty hooks and fire because it's nothing but hooks hanging everywhere and open flames all over the place. And she's absolutely right. It's the most absurd factory. I don't know what they make here. And there's so much open flames and it's just, it's so over the top and so ludicrous. And it makes it a wild ride to watch. It's honestly probably one of the most fun 80s goofy tough guy action movies I've seen. And I've been revisiting a bunch of those over the years. So absolutely, Cobra starring Stallone is fantastic. The collector's edition, Crime is the Disease and He is the Cure. It also has a whole bunch of new interviews on the Shout Factory Blu-ray, plus a whole bunch of the old vintage audio commentary and featurettes and teasers and trailers and that sort of thing that was already on the previous DVD. So if you like 80s action, get Cobra because it is a hoot.
It rocks.
Excellent. Yay!
And that is it. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about movies like Miss Bella and a bunch of other stuff the studios are burying in the sewer. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.